Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the Andy Finn Show.
A smooth talk of the town.
Cool. Well, all right. We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and we are talking on October 20th, 2 weeks and 1 day before the 2008 election. We are talking about voter suppression. So the fourth way in which Republicans and conservatives have a systematic approach to suppressing the vote is voter registration laws that require voters to have picture ID. The idea is if you have to have a picture ID, that would stop people from voting when they shouldn't vote or voting as someone they aren't. First of all, no one has demonstrated that that's a big problem. It's a minuscule number of people. Some ridiculous number, ridiculously low number of people have been convicted of voter fraud in the last 10 years. It's you know, a couple hundred people out of over 100 million votes cast, you know, every presidential election, or close to, maybe it's 70 million cast every presidential election. In any case, several states have passed these. Georgia passed a law, and the Supreme Court upheld it, said you can require a license. Indiana passed a similar law. You may remember the story from the primaries last May, when an election official in Indiana, 10 nuns showed up at the polling place to vote, and they didn't let them vote because they didn't have picture ID. Now, keep in mind, these are women who've been voting every year or every election for, you know, much of their lives. Suddenly they're being told, you can't vote. Why? They couldn't show a picture ID to show they were who they said they were, right? They showed up in their habits, but he didn't believe they were the sisters they said they were, apparently. Why didn't they have licenses? Hey, there's three categories of people, at least, that are less likely to have a picture ID than the average American. You and I have a driver's license. I've got a picture ID for the place where I work. I have a passport. Right? The average poor person doesn't have a passport, doesn't have a picture ID in their job where they work, and they may not have a driver's license. People that live in cities tend not to have driver's license. You know, a lot of people in Manhattan, they let their license expire when they move to Manhattan. You don't, if you don't own a car and you don't need a car much and drive much, why would you bother getting your license renewed in New York City? Also, a lot of senior citizens, if you stop driving, you know, you get to be 80 years old and you turn in your driver's license, or you stop driving, you let your driver's license expire, you're still voting, but you don't have a driver's license. So then the state passes a law and says you must have a picture ID, and suddenly you don't have a picture ID to your name and you can't vote. So it disproportionately affects people who tend to vote Democratic. Poorer people, senior citizens, although senior citizens actually tend to vote Republican, and people in urban areas. Right? So by requiring picture ID, Republicans know that they are going to help suppress the vote. The fifth issue is rejecting ballots that are spoiled, right, that there's something wrong with them. This hits hardest in low-income precincts. Okay, a lot of times the worst voting equipment and voting machines are in the poorest areas of the country. They also have the fewest machines. They have the longest lines. Last election in 2004, last presidential election, people waited in line 8 hours in some inner city precincts. Okay? And we know that when they looked at the returns from Florida in 2000, and this was the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights looked at this, it wasn't a partisan organization, they found that blacks were nearly 10 times more likely than whites to have their ballots rejected. Okay? And that's true nationwide. Okay? And then we got touchscreen technology, which has proven unreliable, that a lot of states have gone back to paper ballots, but not all of them. We had this glitch in D.C. just a month or so ago in a test they did. It wildly miscounted ballots. They think they figured out what's wrong with the software, but they aren't sure. And then finally, there's the challenging of provisional ballots. Right? In 2004, there were 3 million voters who showed up at the polls and were not given regular ballots, but were given provisional ballots. And it's because their registration was challenged on a technicality. either Democrats or Republicans can show up in precincts and challenge ballots. Okay? And in 2004, about a third of those provisional ballots, right, about a million ballots, were just thrown away at the discretion of the election officials. Now, this leads us to a term you may or may not have heard of called voter caging, right? It comes out of the direct mail world, where they try and cage names. Basically, you want to send your mail to good addresses, not bad addresses. So what there have been some Republican campaigns to do voter caging, and what they do is the GOP sends letters out to thousands of voters, right, to confirm their address, and they tend to focus on minority precincts where they know there's going to be heavy concentrations of Hispanics or blacks that tend to vote Democratic. They send out thousands of them, and if the letter is returned for any reason, that is, it says the person isn't here, they challenge the voter and claim they gave a false address. But there are any number of reasons that can be legitimate. The person could be away at school. They could be serving in the military. Okay. Now, this case just got settled in Ohio. And I think there was one in Michigan. The Republicans wanted to take people off the rolls. And the Supreme Court actually intervened and said, no, you can't do it. What they wanted was a database match. This actually goes back to reason number two that I gave you for the method number two that voter suppression is practiced. But the Supreme Court actually ruled against Republicans and four Democrats in that situation. They wanted to force the state, which is run by Democrats now, and it wasn't 4 years ago in Ohio. They wanted to force them to give them lists, databases from the state level so that they could match and therefore throw out people that didn't match the state databases. So those are the basic methods that that get used for this. But I'd like to just quote from Paul Weyrich. He is one of the architects of today's Republican Party. And this is just to prove to you that this is actually part of the Republican part of the Republican strategy. This is how they get their candidates elected, and it's pretty freely admitted. It's not like I'm making this stuff up, right? Paul Weyrich, he's been involved with the GOP since before Reagan was elected in 1980. And he was scolding evangelical Christians who believe in democracy. And this is an exact quote. He said, many of our Christians have what I call a goo-goo syndrome, good government syndrome. Quote, they want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down. Again, this idea that the fewer people that vote, the better it is for Republican candidates, and therefore the goal is to have fewer people vote. Okay? Since 2003, that's just 5 years, 2.7 million new voters have had their applications to register to vote rejected. Right? So, that is the voter registration, voter fraud, voter suppression issue in a nutshell, in a pretty big nutshell, a pretty detailed explanation. So, when you see the Republican talk show host led by Sean Hannity out there complaining about Acorn and claiming Barack Obama's got ties, close ties to Acorn, which he doesn't, and claiming that Acorn is perpetrating some kind of fraud this election season. Keep in mind what's going on here. Is there some voter registration fraud going on? Yes. People are getting paid by Acorn and are turning in phony names to Acorn, like Mickey Mouse, like the front four of the Dallas Cowboys. But that's really a fraud being perpetrated on Acorn as much as on the state of whichever state they're in. In this case, those examples were from Ohio. And nobody believes that this is going to turn into voter fraud. That is, Mickey Mouse can't show up at the polling place and cast a ballot, can he? And the Dallas Cowboys front four sure as shoot isn't going to show up and vote. So that's not voter fraud. That's voter registration fraud. And they should put the people in prison that do it. Well, I don't know about prison. They should fine them. But Acorn has pretty much been found to be conscientious about this stuff, so that the stuff that they're spouting from Sean Hannity and all the talk show hosts, and it's now infected the McCain campaign. Sarah Palin's out there being a good soldier and repeating it all. It's just nonsense. And they're doing two things. One is they would like to suppress the vote, and this may help them suppress the vote. And secondly, they are trying to build in an excuse so that when Obama-Biden win, they can argue that the election was illegitimate. All right? I'm hoping the margins will be so big the country will laugh at that. You know, when the margin's 537 votes, like it was in Florida in 2000, you can make the case that it could have gone the other way. It's a little harder if the margin's, you know, millions of votes. So we'll see. In any case, we are going to take a short break here on the Andy Finn Show. And when we come back, we are going to talk just a tiny little bit about the Colin Powell endorsement, because this is really, really interesting what's happening with the election just 2 weeks away.
Look at all the angry people. Look at all the angry people. Richard B. Cheney swears that Pat lay in public like so much hot air. And Sissy in Bush care, waits for the weapons, still thinks Iraq was a threat to the U.S. homeland. I can't understand all the Bush appointees. Where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong? Rabbit and Coulter, writing the words to a book that reflects a strange fear. Who would come near, look at her whining, blaming opponents and damning up dubious foe? Is it for show, all the right-wing parrots? Where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong? Look at all the angry people. Look at all the angry people. Ambassador Bolton hates the UN, but now he is a part of it all. He's got some gall, push the divider, renominates rival judges, no change in his tone. And he's not alone, all the angry people, where do they all come from? All the angry people, where do they all belong?
Greetings, sensationalists from across the fruity plains.
You're listening to the Andy Finn Show.
The smooth talk of the town.
Cool. We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and in this last segment, I said I was going to talk about Colin Powell, but I'm actually going to save his endorsement for next week, because there's a detailed explanation of why he thinks Obama's ready and that McCain is actually not ready. I'm going to save that. My son Andy is going to be on the show next week. He will be in town, and he's as rabid as they come on the left. No, he's a 20%er on the left. He's active in the Democratic Party. He was 40 feet from Barack Obama at that rally in Kansas City yesterday. So what I do want to talk about is the latest charge that the right is leveling at Obama, and that McCain and Palin are leveling at Obama, and that is that he is a socialist. It's hard to even take some of this stuff seriously, because let's review the bidding. Earlier this summer, when it was clear that Europe had a different attitude towards America, when they could see that someone in a blue state of mind might take over, and 200,000 people showed up in Germany to see Obama's speech, the McCain campaign tried to tar him as a celebrity. And did they just say he was a celebrity like somebody famous? No, they tried to tie him to a couple of sleazy young women. Right, like he's an airhead or something. And they called him arrogant. Right, their talk show host called him arrogant if McCain didn't. And then they moved on to the fact he might be anti-American, his associations with Reverend Wright, who said some inflammatory things in his church. You know, if your preacher says it, then you must believe it, right? Of course, it doesn't apply to McCain, but it applies to Obama. And then they brought up the Bill Ayers thing, and Sarah Palin started saying that Barack Obama pals around with terrorists. Well, first of all, he's using the present tense, and I don't know anyone who really believes Bill Ayers is a terrorist today. The when they were calling him an unrepentant terrorist, maybe that's okay, but he's not a terrorist today, right? Unless, I mean, I guess that makes George Bush a drunk today, because he was a drunk when he was 40, right? And you say, well, he changed. He repudiated his past, and Bill Ayers hasn't. Bill Ayers has, by his actions, changed. But people are pretty stubborn, and they aren't willing to come out and say that they were wrong if they believe in a principle. And what nobody ever talks about is the fact that Bill Ayers was against the Vietnam War so strenuously that he founded the Weather Underground. And they also don't tell you that when he planted bombs, they were careful not to kill people. Right? So these comparisons to Timothy McVeigh, Rush Limbaugh a week ago was saying that he's like Timothy McVeigh. No. Somebody else, Rush also then went up the ante, and I think it was Rush, maybe it was somebody else, came out and said he was like Osama bin Laden. No, those people were intentionally killing as many Americans as possible. That is absolutely not what Bill Ayers did. Not to defend him, and not to claim that he's repented, because he hasn't. But he didn't say he wished he had bombed more. He said he wished they had done more, meaning to stop the Vietnam War. He thought it was an immoral war, it was an illegal war, and that he didn't want his government anywhere near it. But this idea that somehow he's a terrorist today because he was when he was a young man, I'm not following it. And so Palin and McCain have called him a terrorist in the present tense and accused Obama of palling around with terrorists. No, serving on the same board with him, that would imply that the president of the University of Chicago, I think it was that, and the president of Northwestern University, and these other people who were on the Annenberg board with Obama and Bill Ayers, that they were palling around with terrorists, and I think that would come as a shock to them. Bill Ayers is a member of Chicago society. He is, you know, he's been in political circles for a couple of decades and hasn't raised a stink until the right needs an issue to use against Obama. So, he pals around with terrorists. He's overconfident now. He's measuring the drapes. And now, finally, he's a socialist. Well, let's examine that concept of Barack Obama being a socialist. Why is he a socialist? Because Joe the Plumber emerged, and John McCain mentioned him, I think, 21 times in the last debate, the third debate last Wednesday night, was it? And McCain saw it as a chance to make some hay on the economic issue, because Joe the Plumber criticized Barack Obama's concept of letting the Bush tax cuts expire and letting the rates for taxable income rise to what they were during the Clinton administration. And for that, they want to claim he's a socialist. Now, that's kind of weird. And it's especially a tough sell when you consider that the Bush administration is in the middle of nationalizing some of the banks, nationalizing an insurance company, and bailing out all kinds of people. That's, you know, bordering on socialism, right? Socialism is government ownership, public ownership of I don't know what you want to say, of companies, of resources, right? In general, we collect some fees, but we don't say that the government owns the oil. Now, at some level, I really think that we should be getting more for our natural resources. We're running these huge deficits, but the people own the oil under the ground. and we lease it to companies, and we charge them, well, and some of the mining rights that we get out west and grazing rights, we get pennies on the dollar of what they are worth on the open market. We're giving the stuff away, and we're running big deficits and big debt. So you could make the argument pretty easily for more government ownership of these things, and mostly we don't in this country. You know, they called Hillary a socialist, too, when she was running, and they don't bother calling her that anymore because there's no election coming up that she's involved in. But in fact, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton believe in the free enterprise system. They are not going to try and dismantle it. Are there certain things the free enterprise system doesn't do particularly well? Yes, there are, and they're pretty obvious. We have antitrust laws for a reason. We have certain things that the government can't provide. You know, we have schools that are run by the government. We have the post office that's run by the government. And the reason is, we didn't really believe that free enterprise could run it. That is, nobody would step up and provide mail to people 6 days a week at a certain price. It just wasn't economically feasible. The first thing they would do is say, okay, if this is a private business, we're going to cut back on the hours. We're not going to have Saturday delivery. Then they cut back to delivery 3 days a week. And businesses and individuals and the government itself thought, you know, getting mail 6 days a week, there's a benefit to that. It stimulates commerce. And so we've kept the post office in the hands of the government. It's the same with, you know, the fact the government runs the military. You're not going to privatize that, although we're privatizing parts of it, right, the support staff and things. So there's any number of things that are, quote, socialistic in this country, and that's just the way it is. You're not going to turn everything over to free enterprise. This idea that you can have a free enterprise in schools, as long as you agree everybody has to be educated, you can't have a free enterprise, because free enterprise would allow people to turn down customers. And we have to run our schools in a way that you can't turn down some of the customers. You have to educate everybody. So you're never going to have a real free enterprise there, a real capitalist system. So when it comes to healthcare, it's the same problem. We've got 50 million people roughly falling through the cracks, finding it hard to buy healthcare. We've had a system where the healthcare comes through your job. That's not proving to be as workable anymore. So Obama has a plan to get everybody covered by healthcare. So did Hillary. They're slightly different. But if you want to call that socialism, tell me how everybody's going to get healthcare in this country. Right? And this gets back to the tax structure. Basically, what they're saying is the fact that Obama wants to tax someone who's rich. Joe the plumber wouldn't get a tax increase under Obama, and he now admits that. But the McCain campaign, in particular the right-wing talk show hosts, have seized on this because Obama made the statement to Joe the plumber. He put it in layman's terms, and he said, hey, we want to just spread the wealth around, he said. Well, that can mean any number of things, but Republicans and partisans on the right have taken it to mean, oh, he's a socialist. He wants redistribution of wealth. As though we don't do that all the time. Here's the problem, and here's how you answer the argument when a right winger tells you that the Democrats want redistribution of wealth and that a progressive income tax is a redistribution of wealth. Who says that the distribution of wealth in the first place was a natural process? Republicans act as though the free enterprise system is handed down from on high and that there's some natural law that governs capitalism and that if the government could just get out of the way, we'd have a perfectly working market. No. Markets exist because governments put them in place, whether it's tariffs on incoming goods or no tariffs, whether it's income tax or no income tax, whether it's the legal rights to sign contracts. Those are sanctioned by the government. If we didn't have government, we wouldn't have contracts. If we didn't have contracts, we wouldn't have agreements between companies to buy products for certain amounts. We wouldn't have commerce without government. So government sets up the initial system that we call free enterprise and makes the rules, and that determines who gets ahead and who doesn't. Now, does hard work in that contribute? Absolutely. That's a huge part of it, but let's not pretend that the government doesn't make and break the winners to begin with. And the rules make and break the winners. And then we have the tax system. So the winners have the money, and we all have a certain amount of money, and then the tax system says how much you keep, how much you give to the government. And we currently tax in what we call a progressive system, although it's gotten less and less progressive since the 60s, to the point where it's nowhere near as progressive as it used to be. And what the Bush tax cuts did is it made it less progressive. Obama's saying the Bush tax cuts are scheduled to expire. I'm going to let them expire at the high end because I'm willing to let them go back to the rates that we had during the Clinton administration. There were no tax rates above 40%. Right? We're still talking going from 35, which is what we have under the Bush, for the highest income brackets, from 35 to 39.5, I think it is. Still under 40%. Okay, so it's hardly socialism, and it's hardly wealth redistribution in that what the government does is it decides how we structure this and how much money can people can make from the initial system. Basically, the rules are set up the way the rules are set up, and then the tax structure is the way the tax structure is, and we tweak it around the margins. But it hardly makes somebody a socialist to say they're willing to settle for higher rates than George W. Bush was willing to settle for. Let's not forget that during this time, Bush started with a surplus, and we were starting to pay down the national debt, which was in the range of between $5 and $7 trillion and going down. And we're now looking at about $10 trillion in debt once Bush is out of office. And the deficits are running $500 billion a year. Bush had a plan to cut the deficit in half by the time he left office. That was 4 years ago. What deficit, I said? Well, you didn't have one when you started. He hasn't cut it in half. He's made it larger. So the Republicans in general liked cutting taxes. That's all McCain talks about. They don't like balancing the budget. They don't like cutting spending. So they have the starve the beast approach, that is, cut the funding off and then the next people in will have to make cuts because we don't have the money to do anything about it. That's the chicken's way out. There's nothing responsible about that approach. That is saying, I don't have the guts to cut spending. I'm just going to cut taxes. Everybody's happy about that. And so if that's somehow capitalism or responsible behavior, I'm mystified by it because, as I've said before, if the Democrats are the party of tax and spend, the Republicans are the party of borrow and spend. And I'd much rather be paying for the spending we're doing than charging it to our children and our grandchildren. And that's what we're doing currently. In any case, that'll do it for another edition of the Andy Finn Show. I'll be back next Monday with my son, Andy, to talk about the current state of the election 1 week out. It's going to be fun because I think we're heading for a fairly predictable conclusion here. And Rush Limbaugh ain't going to like it. Remember, do it. Don't doubt it.